Salo Falava, I'm Afamasanga Seyuli Salamasina Von Reiki, and I'm inviting you to join me on a journey through the evolution of our Pacific cultures on Culture Compass. We'll meet incredible people dedicated to preserving traditions while adapting them for today's world. Join me as we travel the Pacific to celebrate our resilience, revival, and deep-rooted connection.
Search for Culture Compass wherever you get your podcasts to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
Iorana, Morina, Ali and Good Bella Day. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Today on the show, Bougainville's leaders have condemned a higher voting threshold in PNG's parliament that could make independence even harder to achieve.
I think it is mischievous, and I think it's deliberate attempt to ensure that the ratification fails even before it starts.
Meanwhile, is outside help the answer to PNG's law and order challenges?
It's a new approach in Papua New Guinea, you know, an approach that probably would not be acceptable in some other parts of the Pacific.
And voter turnout may drastically affect the upcoming elections in New Caledonia. Those stories and more, we'd like to acknowledge that our show comes to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. I'm your host, Aggie Dubois, and I say maruru. Thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. Firstly, in Papua New Guinea, the appointment of two Australians to senior positions in the National Police Force has caused a stir, sparking debate about foreign involvement in the country's police force and whether outside help is the answer to PNG's law and order challenges. Natasha Emick reports.
4 years after leaving Papua New Guinea, Amanda Cates got a call that she wasn't expecting.
Commissioner Manning rang me up earlier this year and said, would I like to come to back to Papua New Guinea as the police provincial commander for East New Britain? And I jumped at it.
As a senior officer with the Australian Federal Police, she helped lead Australia's policing partnership in PNG for 2 years during COVID. She never worked out of East New Britain during that time, but a call from the Police Commissioner David Manning saw her swap one uniform for another and join the ranks of the Royal PNG Constabulary.
I think the most important thing that he wanted was stability in leadership and fair leadership and an ability to mentor and develop the future leaders within the RPNGC.
3 weeks into the job and her appointment has become a part of a wider debate. Some have questioned why an Australian was chosen for the senior police role instead of a local officer. Commander Kate says she's read some of the criticisms being aired online.
And I've read those comments, and it is something that, you know, affects me, and I'm saying, well, why did I come? You know, what am I going to bring? But I think it is, it needs a change.
She believes her perspective and a lack of prior connections in the province allow her to approach the role with greater independence.
An outside influence can just tweak things to be able to say, well, what about we do it this way? What about we do it that way? And I think it's important to not destabilise, but just to shake things up a little bit.
Professor Sinclair Dinan from the Australian National University explains that Commander Kate's appointment is part of a wider effort to reinvigorate the RPNGC, unveiled by Prime Minister James Marape in 2023.
It's a new approach in Papua New Guinea, and it's, you know, an approach that probably would not be acceptable in some other parts of the Pacific.
He says the plan includes recruiting around 20 foreign officers for senior leadership positions. So far, at least 4 people have been recruited, all from Australia.
Whether or not, you know, there are going to be more of them, one depends on, you know, supply and people, you know, sticking up their hands and saying, yes, that's what I want to do. And two, it depends on the Australian government being prepared to fund them.
Another new recruit is Stephen Harris, a former AFP officer who took over command in Anger 4 months ago.
I've flipped the focus here that we don't worry about who's fighting on the ground in the first instance. We'll pick some of them up if we can, but we now focus on the leaders.
Anger has experienced years of deadly tribal violence, and he says the majority of Angans are desperate for peace. He's taken a hardline approach on law and order as well as cleaning up his ranks.
Number one was making sure that the discipline of the members in the province was at the standard that should be expected. And when I arrived at wasn't. The degree of absenteeism was quite high. Sometimes that's because people were afraid to come to work, and other times, more often, it was because they didn't want to.
But others on the ground are afraid of how bringing outside appointments will impact morale within the force. William Kopongi from the PNG National Research Institute has been talking with local officers in Anger about the latest changes.
In terms of those discipline issues like punctuality, many have been already suspended. So that's sort of like bringing in fear among the officers. They may be also only there to please the PPC, but actual work on the ground might not be done as they should. That's my fear. This kind of atmosphere is, I think, it's not really good for the police officers.
He believes that outside officers could help in short-term support roles, but he questions whether they are needed in full command of provincial policing.
I was thinking that they can bring their officers in to assist and support for a certain period of time. Would be much better than asking them directly to take the commanding officer's position to actually run the province as PPC. Otherwise, I'm happy that they come in, but whether the officers on the ground will work with them peacefully or not, that's another question that I have.
And that is William Kopongi ending that report by Natasha Emick. And just a note, Pacific Beat has reached out to PNG's Police Commissioner David Manning for comment, but we have not yet had a response.
What's up, ABC Radio Australia listeners? I'm Sosafina Formoli, and I want you to come hang with me for On The Record, your weekly deep dive into the music that moves the Pacific. We'll talk about the big tracks that inspire your favourite Pacific music artists and the real stories behind them. Plus, we'll uncover some gems that you might not know yet, keeping the heart of the Pacific alive and thumping. Catch On The Record Mondays at 3 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. Now, Bougainville's leaders have condemned a move by Papua New Guinea's parliament to impose a three-quarters majority for any vote to ratify Bougainville's independence referendum. The threshold was adopted earlier this month and would apply when parliament considers the result of Bougainville's 2019 referendum, in which the overwhelming majority of Bougainvillians voted for independence. Reporter Finau Fonua spoke to Bougainville's Vice President, Ezekiel Massat, who says it's a deliberate attempt to ensure the ratification fails.
There's a bit of tension. Nobody doubts that. There's a bit of toing and froing in terms of the media statement. That is understandable because we have a next round of Melanesian agreement talks that is scheduled for next week. So I can understand the tension that's currently existing between the two governments. When the Burnham talks concluded, it concluded with the phasing out of the moderator phase, Sejeri's involvement, and things progressed. We came up with a Melanesian agreement. Now, in that Melanesian agreement, the task of working on the sessional order, in particular the voting threshold, was a joint responsibility of the two speakers. Coming back from Fiji, there was no agreement on the sessional order voting threshold. So we were surprised the speaker had unilaterally proceeded with the three-quarter argument. I'm more angry for Bougainville Affairs, and the Prime Minister also spoke in support when that responsibility to oversee the work of the speakers and the work of the Melanesian agreement is a responsibility for Mr. Honorable Makiba and myself. Had there been any feedback that there had been an agreement by the two speakers, it's also important to note that coming back from Fiji, the national speaker had reached out for a meeting, a joint meeting between the speakers and myself and Minister Makiba. We turned up for those meetings on two occasions, and he ended up, to our surprise, he has now come up with a nonsense three-quarter majority. So I think the national government is negotiating in bad faith. I have put forward an option to the national government. This matter is now a matter that there's nothing on the side of the Bougainville Parliament who can do anything, nor does any discussions among the technical officials will amount to anything. The option that I have given is for another motion, rescinding the three-quarter motion.
and instead put forward the two governments' position of simple majority and two-thirds majority. That's the position we're in at the moment.
The fact that they would push for a absolute majority, does that indicate that they are trying to prevent Bougainville from being independent?
They have passed a motion stating the requirement of a three-quarter voting threshold. To me, that's an impossibility. There's no way in the Constitution there is a requirement for a three-quarter voting threshold unless you are voting on a change of the boundaries for the sovereign state of Papua New Guinea. I think it is mischievous, and I think that's, like you have posed, I think it's a deliberate attempt to ensure that the ratification fails even before it starts.
I read that Bougainville was considering other means. Does that mean that Bougainville would declare independent if that were to occur? If that situation were to occur, Bougainville would declare independence without the Papua New Guinea government's endorsement?
We have another two strategy that's simultaneously at play. Our preferred option was to gain independence through the Bougainville Peace Agreement, which is through a referendum. In light of the national government putting up very serious obstacles in attempting to make that option is frustrated, Bougainville is left in no option, but you consider the other two options. The other two options that Bougainville will consider has no national government input. Having said that, we're not rushing to make that declaration. I have made it absolutely clear is that we are close to that day. The moment my instructions are for the technical officials and leaders to continue to negotiate the Melanesian agreement outcome, and that talk starts next week. It is next week that the president will put forward the final Bougainville position on this issue of independence. And the national government is at liberty to accept or reject on this issue. As you might have gathered in the last couple of days, the prime minister has come out and given this option that maybe a self-government could be imposed with an independence the 15-year mark. That is the sort of option that we're looking at, but at a much shorter period. I think there's some middle ground there. It's not all doom and gloom. The instructions are for the Melanesian agreement discussions to continue and that our team will be attending in good faith, despite what's been happening on the periphery.
And that is Bougainville's Vice President Ezekiel Masata speaking there to reporter Finau Fonua. Meanwhile, it has been 2 weeks since villagers in remote parts of Papua New Guinea's Manus province woke to find their waters covered in small volcanic rocks. The debris has stopped communities from fishing, swimming and travelling by sea to the mainland, raising concerns about dwindling food supplies. The PNG government has announced 5 million kina in relief assistance. But residents say help is urgently needed, and they are hoping supplies arrive sooner rather than later. PNG reporter Belinda Cora spoke with Manus Islander Lital Pokanau.
Mr. Pokanau, how are people on the islands affected feeling right now after the government announced its 5 million kina relief supply?
The people, they are not excited, and I think recent is many government services and like we only had hear them and they come as promises. Many times we do not see the actual money or funding coming to the villages. So this doesn't change anything in the village. This news is received just as any other news. Just wait, not expecting, and yet stop the sir. And the LLGs officers and president coming to our village and getting some reports or checking the needs on the island. People are hearing those news coming in.
What is their biggest concern right now in the situation on ground?
The people on the islands are having, that is food. When the boomies begin to fill the sea, then chances for going out to the sea and find fish to sell at the market, get money to buy food and at the store, or the chances have come down. So we only live on what we have in the village, like sagos from the mainland, but to buy food from the store. Many people, as far as they are saying, they have not eaten any food from the store since. It's 1 month now. That is one big issue that is affecting the people. Seeing that the Prime Minister has given 5 million kina and the allocation would be distributed in food and medical care, that is one thing that they look forward to if the government is truly aluminium when I'm only talk. Like I'm helping straight outside the Kai Kai. Also, lately, parents who have students, their children in high school, they had to go and get their children from the high school at holiday term break. They were struggling to buy fuel because there was no money. Only go on credit to make sure their children came home just this week. The issue that is affecting the people is shortage of money.
What are the village's expectations?
Okay, the biggest expectation for the people is, as I have said, that is if the supply the government can provide is for the food, the site, the Kai Kai. The coastal areas, they are, as far as we know, they have been affected more than the people on the island because the pumis, they remain blocked at the bay areas where the communities at the bay, those are volcano stones, they went there. But on the islands, I believe the big expectation is the government will be giving out the food supply, so that will help in meeting the need for store rations or store food.
Are there any changes to the pumice on the islands?
Because the tides are coming in all directions. Pumice did not stay for long. Like it came overnight, two nights, and then went away. So our beaches are cleared as I'm speaking today. There are no more pumice around the beach and also where close to the reef, close to the reef. But at the mainland, that's where they got stuck. The areas where you got bay long end, they all got stuck now. All boats, the boats cannot go over to the beach, but had to stop at the other end and walk over to the communities that at the bay. The side of the island, and the sea is already clear. Some people are going out fishing, getting not big amount of fish, but the pumice that came and that come overnight, people collected it and they had a chance to move it on shore, and they are using it backfilling the swamp area and even making some seawalls, backfilling the seawalls or sea rise level. Yeah, tides are coming here and there and making a cleaning. I'm cleaning up now a big place. The tide's going only one way. Hardly by taking time for the pumice to drift away.
And that there is Manus Islander Litau Pokanau speaking there with Belinda Cora. All right, now New Caledonia is preparing for crucial provincial elections this week that are shaping up as a major test of the territory's future. The elections have been delayed since 2024 after deadly riots over voting rights rocked the French territory. This week's election will decide the makeup of the provincial assemblies and Congress, and the result could determine who leads renewed negotiations with France and how much support there is for the new political settlement after the collapse of the Bougival Accord. So joining me now from New Caledonia's capital, New Mayor, is Islands business reporter Nick McLennan with that. Good morning, Nick.
Good morning, Aggie.
Yeah, look.
Actually, I'm up in the Northern Province, just outside of Kone, the provincial capital. As you say, there are three provincial assemblies up for grabs in the voting on Sunday. And so I've left Noumea to have a look at what's happening in the rest of the country, because there are often very different debates between the rural and regional areas with Kanak majority populations compared to the capital. Interesting times.
Absolutely. Well, I must say, what's the atmosphere like there with the lead up to the polls?
It's surprisingly quiet. There are a range of electoral lists campaigning for these elections, 11 competing lists in the south, 5 here in the Northern Province and 7 in the Loyalty Islands. Despite that, it's remarkably quiet. All of the lists are holding community meetings. They call Réunion de Proximité, speaking to small groups of people. I'm heading off this morning to the town of Poya, where some political leaders are going to be speaking with local business community about their vision for the future. It doesn't have, however, on the surface, the same sort of flash as many elections. And I think partly that's a level of tiredness and fatigue from many people I've spoken to. New Caledonia's been through a decade of difficult economic times with COVID, with energy crisis, then the conflict, as you mentioned, 6 months of conflict in 2024 that really devastated the economy. So a lot of people are really focused on day-to-day issues about cost of living, about paying the rent, jobs and problems for young people, as much as the focus on the big picture of New Caledonia's political future.
Mm. Well, Nick, I understand that there is quite a significant cut to the actual number of polling stations in Noumea. I'm wondering why has that happened, and is this something that could probably challenge? I mean, what are the challenges that could people face when they are going to cast their vote?
At the last elections in 2019, 7 years ago, there were about 50 polling stations scattered around the capital, Noumea, the municipality of Noumea, in schools, in town halls, in other public buildings. In 2024, during the crisis for the legislative elections held that year in July, the French High Commission reduced the number of polling booths where people could go and vote. There's been a lot of criticism from parts of the independence movement about this, and from other smaller parties like Éveil au Sénien, which has a lot of support from the large Wallisian and Islander community here in New Caledonia. In the northern suburbs, the poorer suburbs of Noumea, the capital, it's often people don't have access to a car, many households. Less than half the households have access to a car. So for some people, it's difficult to get to the polling stations. The French authorities have defended this decision and say that despite this, the level of abstention is not affected. But the bus company, Taneo Bus Company, which runs the local bus services, has decided to add a special service on election day, Sunday the 28th, simply because since 2024, the buses don't run on Sundays. So if you live in one of the far-flung northern suburbs of the capital, there's no public transport normally. And the public protest and criticism of this has led to the Taneo Bus Company to run a service that'll just assist people, you know, vulnerable people who find it hard to get around to get to their polling booths.
Yes, and this is the thing, though, when you talk about, you know, the country being tired, a lot of fatigue, do you think that was contributed because of the election when it was delayed following the unrest in 2024? I mean, how heavily do you think the memory of those events are going to be weighing on voters? Do you think it's going to shape the way they cast their ballots?
I think it's certainly much calmer here. There's a police presence around in the capital. There was a music festival on Saturday night in Noumea with a large police presence. But I think the memory of the violence and conflict that racked New Caledonia in 2024 is still strong in people's memories. But it depends who you talk to. Certainly, people in the wealthy southern suburbs, particularly of European heritage, were freaked out by the violence, which was really focused on Noumea, on the capital, rather than the northern province or the Loyalty Islands province. Similarly, there are many young people who are frankly wary of politicians. They feel that the benefits of the last 25-odd years of political change under the Noumea Accord, the framework agreement that's governed New Caledonia up until now, many young people feel that they haven't benefited from that. And despite its wealth, New Caledonia is still a society riven by a range of social, political, cultural inequalities. Mm. And you see that with young people. I was speaking to some young people last night, and many of them feel that they're not particularly interested in voting. The independence parties are desperately seeking to explain to their audience that if you don't vote, you're effectively giving power to the, particularly in the southern province, to the loyalist and conservative anti-independence parties. The Loyalists and the main independent anti-independence party, Rassemblement, have formed a joint ticket in the south, which will ensure that, as currently the state, the southern province remains in conservative hands. The real battle is whether they can the conservative anti-independence forces can gain a majority both in the southern province and in the National Congress as a whole. And we'll have to wait till Sunday to see. There's a lot of uncertainty about whether some of the smaller parties can make a breakthrough. There's an electoral threshold to win a seat in these elections. You have to get beyond 5% of the registered voters. Now, there's 190,000-odd people registered to vote, and so it's a significant challenge for smaller parties or smaller coalitions to get beyond the 5%. And if you don't get 5%, your votes are essentially wasted. And so we may see, despite the fact there are 11 lists competing in the south, a number of those will fall by the wayside by not reaching this this electoral threshold.
Well, and you talk about, you know, young people themselves. Out of that 190,000 people, what's interesting could be really like just one person's level of interest, right, in politics. Does that play heavily into, you know, someone going to cast their vote?
I think so. And look, there's a variety of different responses, and this is true in every country. Some people are avidly involved in political life. They, you know, can afford the time to read the newspapers, follow the news every night after the news on TV. Different political parties get allocated time to present their vision in short video clips. So the information's out there if you're interested. But a lot of people are focused on daily life. I interviewed one leading independence politician, and he said, look, people are concerned about getting enough to eat in some poorer families, you know, to get some, say, a biscuit, a tin of sardines, something to eat is their number one priority, paying the rent. And so this is a real, you know, this is a real economically difficult time for New Caledonia, not just because of the 2024 events, but even for beyond that with COVID and so on. Key industries like tourism and nickel have been badly hit by global affairs, and that's not been helped by the war in Iran. The US and Israeli attack on Iran, which has affected energy prices, affected tourism with the cost of aviation fuel for people flying from Europe. So key industries like the nickel smelting and mining have been really hard hit over the past 10 years. And, you know, I think people are hoping this election will be a circuit breaker, will be a way where there can be a mandate for political leaders to then look forward to the future to address not only the economy, but also the broader political status. After the collapse of the so-called Bougival Accord, the French National Assembly rejected this draft political statute for New Caledonia after months of negotiation. Prime Minister Sébastien Lecornu, the French Prime Minister, has talked about convening another round of talks after the elections. And so, as suggested, it's really crucial to see who will hold a majority in the provinces, but particularly in the National Congress and in the government, which will have to be elected out of the Congress in coming weeks.
But looking ahead, though, Nick, overall, does it look like people are feeling a little bit hopeful with this election coming up this Sunday?
It's quite varied. I think many people that I've spoken to have been pleased that elections will be held. They were due to be held in May 2024, but of course that was the time, the 13th of May, when the riots and protests erupted in New Caledonia as France tried to push through changes to voting rights, the definition of New Caledonian citizen. These elections are being held on a restricted electoral roll. So New Caledonian citizens rather than all French nationals are eligible to vote. So people, I think, have been pleased that finally there's a chance to have their say, to choose political leaders. There's a number of coalitions who describe themselves as the centre, who are trying to present a vision of unity, coming together, and trying to suggest that the two main blocks, anti-independence, pro-independence, don't represent all points of view. So I think people will turn out to vote. The level of abstention, though, will be a significant indicator about how people are feeling. My crystal ball's broken, I'm afraid. Many people are uncertain about how many of the smaller lists will get a breakthrough to be represented in the eventual result.
appreciate your time this morning, Nick. All the best. And obviously, I know we will be keeping in touch with you as those results tune out or will come around after Sunday.
This week, most nights, there are final campaign meetings to mark the end of the campaign for the big electoral lists. Propaganda finishes on Friday night, so Saturday will be quiet. You're not allowed to campaign on Saturday. And then it's out to the polling booths on Sunday the 28th.
All right. Well, thank you again for joining us this morning, Nick. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Aggie. Speak to you again.
Yes, that is Island Business reporter Nick McLennan speaking to me from New Caledonia's capital at Noumea here on Pacific Beat.
Join Jacob McQuire and Michael Chow for Nisha Daily every weekday morning on ABC Radio Australia.
Ka-ka! That was the Eagles this morning with Live in the Boss Lane.
Hang on, pause. Never in the history of radio. This is the world first. I want to guarantee there's never been a radio announcer in the world that has back announced the Eagles with a caca.
What do you mean, the Eagles?
Nisha Daily, weekday mornings from 7 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Thanks for tuning in to Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aggie Dubol. Here's your quick recap of the show so far. In Papua New Guinea, debates spark over foreign involvement in the country's police force. Meanwhile, Bougainville leaders condemn PNG's parliament for a threshold that could deliberately cause Bougainville's independence referendum to fail. And, of course, you would have just heard voter turnout may drastically affect the upcoming elections in New Caledonia. Still to come, though, we might be looking into Timor-Leste hitting with higher transport fees. All right, to sport now. In about 3 hours, New Zealand will take on Egypt at the FIFA World Cup. Known as the All Whites, the New Zealand's national soccer team heads into the match on top of a draw against Iran in their opener. A win would maintain their position at the top of the group and put them in prime position to progress into the next stage of the World Cup. And on the line to talk about this is Matt Brown, Media Operations Manager for the Oceania Football Confederation. With that, I say good morning, Matt.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for joining us this morning. I must say, a win against Egypt would be pretty historic, right? As from what I understand, New Zealand has never won a game at the World Cup, but maybe this could be it, right?
Well, we dare to dream, and it would be. It would be the biggest result in New Zealand football history, without a doubt, because the All Whites went to Spain in 82, and they had 3 losses there. They then, in 2010, it was an amazing achievement, but 3 draws in group play, didn't lose a match, but went out in the group stage, and, of course, drawing the opening match against Iran last week. It means that if they do beat Egypt, that would give them 4 points, and almost, certainly into the next round. 4 points will get teams through either as one of the top 2 teams or one of the best third place teams in the group. So yeah, it would be an amazing achievement. Incredibly difficult task though, against an Egyptian side that I thought were pretty good against Belgium. They have the likes of, I know your listeners will know these names, Mamouche, Man City fame, and of course Mo Salah, attacking players of Liverpool fame. So world class forwards that New Zealand will have to do a lot of defending, but they showed against they certainly showed against Iran. They can attack, they can score goals themselves. Elijah Just, with that brace, and Chris Wood, the Nottingham Forest striker, setting them up. So they've certainly got the ability to hurt teams, but they will have to play as well and better than they did the other day, certainly defensively, to be able to get something out of the game.
Well, can I just ask then, Matt, how significant is it for the Pacific Island region and the OFC for New Zealand to be in this World Cup?
Oh, it's very significant because this is the first time that Oceania has ever had direct entry to the World Cup. Of course, the World Cup expanded to 48 teams this time from 32. So, yes, there are more teams. Oceania has 1.5 spots. It used to have a half spot, so it would always have to play off against the likes of a South American side, a CONCACAF side, or an Asia Confederation side. And that was the route to the World Cup final. It was incredibly difficult. And, of course, New Zealand had only got through that route on 2 occasions in their history or an Oceania team. So really tough. But now with direct entry, the winner of the OFC World Cup qualifiers qualifies for the World Cup, and the runner-up goes to the playoff tournament, which is where New Caledonia went and gave a good account of themselves in Mexico earlier this year, losing to Jamaica, but certainly showing that, you know, there's potential to hopefully you know, get two teams in the future. But yeah, it's significant that they're there in the first place, but also as the lowest ranked team, that they are competitive, and they were extremely competitive against Iran, could have won the match, led twice. So in terms of the development of football, it also shows that there is a pathway through Oceania, you know, to the World Cup, and that, you know, because there was a lot of talk, certainly in recent years, that New Zealand perhaps is the strongest team, should go, should, like Australia did in 2006, join Asia, and go where there's a lot, you know, tougher qualifying games, etc. But I think the Kiwis have shown that, you know, they can be, staying in Oceania, they're certainly developing at a rate, and the island teams are starting to push them more and more to be able to be competitive at a World Cup.
Well, then, Matt, you know, we understand the All Whites, they drew level with a highly ranked Iran last week, you know, 2-2. They're currently at the top of their group. In all honesty, is this a major surprise at all?
Well, it's only because it's only one match in. You know, both matches drew. So, and if I look at the other match in the group that's on at the moment, is Iran against Belgium, and with what, 10 minutes to go or so, it's goalless. So a win today would take the All Whites to the top of the group. Like, they would have 4 points, and you'd have one team on 1 point, Egypt, and two on 2 points going into, you know, the last round of matches. New Zealand play world number six Belgium in the last game. So look, the simple equation is, yes, it is, I guess, a surprise that we got a point. I certainly thought New Zealand would potentially struggle against the pace of Iran's attack. They score a lot of goals, but we really did play well and certainly deserved that point in that match. So, you know, they've risen to the occasion. It's also good because they've got players of Pacific heritage in the squad. The goalkeeper, Michael Boxall, Cook Islands heritage, defender Michael Boxall, Samoan heritage. Sadly, Marco Staminich, the third player of Pacific heritage from with Samoan background, he was ruled out like training days just before the first match and is out of the squad now. But you know, that's also very good for, you know, for the Pacific to have players, you know, from the Pacific Islands, Pacifica, who've come through to make the New Zealand side.
Yeah, I think that's such a really encouraging thing for anyone who has, look, an ounce, an inch of Pacific heritage or Māori heritage. I'm just wondering, though, could you talk a little bit more about that, you know, the what that looks like for future players?
Well, New Zealand football has a very, you know, a really good development pathway programs for kids coming through. And of course, in New Zealand, if you look at the makeup, say, of a city like Auckland, for example, there are huge Pacifica communities. And I know New Zealand football works really hard to get Pacifica kids who often are lured by rugby league, but to play football, and there are a lot more kids coming through. So that goes to show that what they're doing is working, but also that there are going to be opportunities for those kids, you know, to develop through the system here. And that's a big thing for you know, the identity of New Zealand football. I mean, incredibly inclusive in terms of the number of players from different nationalities within the setup. And I don't just mean at the national team, but I look at youth level as well, women's football too. There are players of Pacific heritage, which is really, really good. The other thing that that has happened too with the development of the OFC Pro League, you're getting more Pacifica kids, more players from the islands, opportunities to, you know, and also I guess inspiration to become professional footballers, which is ultimately going to, you know, going to lead to more representation as well, not just for New Zealand, but for other Pacifica teams as they strive to, you know, to reach the level of New Zealand. So yeah, there's certainly a lot of positives there in terms of the sort of the makeup and the pathways for Pacifica players here in New Zealand, but also through the islands.
Well, look, we saw in Vanuatu massive parades, right, celebrating the World Cup, and just the fact that the tournament and sport means a lot for many of our Pacific communities. Is that how you've seen it? I mean, again, to see a Pacific Islander in the FIFA World Cup, right, it really does promote that sport a lot more.
Oh, without a doubt. You know, role models are massive in sport, you know, whatever sport, you know, and to see, you know, if you're sitting back in Apia now and you're watching that match in a few hours' time, you know, to know that Michael Boxall is proud of his heritage, as is the injured Marco Staminich. I mean, he talks a lot about his connection through his mum, and so I think it is inspiring. And we saw these parades, you know, just getting into the fever of the World Cup, football match. Countries like Vanuatu, as you mentioned, Solomon Islands also had a parade. They are just really, you know, really into it. And although their national teams are not competing there, you know, it's a global game. And whether or not New Zealand or Australia, where you're based, you know, was there or not, we're all still glued to this global, you know, showpiece, the biggest sporting event, you know, on the planet, bar none.
Absolutely. And I do have to ask, though, what's your prediction, Egypt or New Zealand?
Oh, look, I'm working for OFC, so I've got to support and I'm a Kiwi, so the New Zealand to cause a big upset. It would be an upset, but I'd love to see it happen today.
Of course, we all love that underdog story, don't we? Exactly. Matt, always great to catch up with you. Really appreciate you coming on the show this morning.
Not a problem. Thank you.
No worries. That is Matt Brown, Media Operations Manager for the Oceania Football Confederation. And yes, we have to say good luck to the All Whites. That is all we got here on Pacific Beat, right here on Pacific Beat. Now, Timor-Leste has introduced higher vehicle registration and transport fees, prompting concern from motorists and public transport users. The new charge ranged from around $135 Australian dollars for motorcycles to more than $285 for heavy vehicles. The government says the fees are designed to encourage owners to renew expired documents, but critics say the increases come as fuel prices remain high and were introduced without enough public consultation. Our Timor-Leste reporter Vonya Vieira hit the streets of the capital Dili to find out how people are feeling.
We work in the private sector to make a living, but daily life is very difficult because the government raised transport taxes without taking poorer people like us into account.
As public transport users, we are very concerned because vehicle document fees have risen to $56. And driver's license fees to $84. Now that fuel prices have increased, transportation tax has risen as well.
The government's decision to raise taxes has a major impact. Look at the reality. Life in our country is hard. Fuel prices have risen and taxes have increased too. We are saddened that taxes keep going up. I urge the government to pause and take stock of people's current living conditions. Please consider fuel prices and the tax increases being imposed.
Yes, the impact is greater on us. Fuel prices have also gone up. For example, if a business runs, sometimes it makes money, sometimes it doesn't. Expenses keep coming, so I cannot make any profit.
And that's Timor-Leste local Bernardino da Costa speaking there to our reporter, Vonya Vieira.
Wherever you're listening, from Timor to Tonga, ABC Radio Australia is yours in the Pacific. Yours for news.
Me taki ma'ata and welcome back to Pacific Beat. Now, Fiji and Palau, they've put their hands up to host a major Pacific climate meeting.
Yours for sport.
Welcome everyone to Nation Footy, the best place for Pacifica footy news and stories in the rugby league and rugby union world.
Yours for music.
Aaron Sister Sounds are heading from Fiji to Aotearoa for something a little bit different, to an artist called Ma. She's got such a unique style, singing in her Māori.
Yours for Pacific stories.
Lafi Moala. Welcome to Stories from the Pacific. Now, what made you decide to create Times of Tonga?
It was a time that I need to make a contribution to my country.
And yours for celebrating Pacific culture.
Niger Daily producer took a trip to the Te Papata Arts Centre.
Skilled artisans creating traditional Samoan objects out of material.
Wherever you are, ABC Radio Australia is yours in the Pacific.
And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Looking back at some of our stories today, Bougainville's leaders have condemned a move by Papua New Guinea's parliament to impose a three-quarters majority for any vote to ratify Bougainville's independence referendum. And volcanic debris continues to swamp waters around Manus Island in PNG. The government has announced, though, a 5 million kina in relief assistance. Now, you can find those stories when you type Pacific Beat or Radio Australia into your search engine. But our team will be back at the same time at 6 a.m. PNG time tomorrow. But you can hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia, though, because your news is next. And coming up after that, yes, it is Nisha Daily. So until next time, o tua o whātou. This is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.